So my topic today is asymptotic expansions for cosmological solutions of the Einstein equations. And in this talk I will be considering solutions of the Einstein equations coupled to matter in general. We've had quite a lot of vacuum this week. Today we'll have a little bit more matter. And these solutions are such that they can be considered as cosmological models. More specifically, what I will be concerned with here are two important asymptotic regimes, which we all know, namely the approach to an initial singularity and the situation of a phase of unending expansion. Now, these two situations seem at first sight quite different. In the first case, there will be past incomplete causal geodesics, as is the usual definition of a singularity. In the second case, at least in favorable situations, future-directed causal geodesics will all be complete. However, I hope to show you that actually there are some significant similarities between these two apparently different situations, and that we can take information from the one situation and use it in the other. One comment I should make before I go further is that in this talk, I will be dealing almost exclusively with spacetimes without any symmetries. There are not so many results for spacetimes without symmetries, but those are the ones that I'm concentrating on here. And in particular, certain negative statements I might make, like there is no example known of such and such, is to be understood in the sense that there are no examples known without symmetry assumptions. So just as a cautionary remark to start with. Okay, so the general setup is I consider a globally hyperbolic spacetime with a global time function t, and this time function will take values in some interval t minus t plus, depending on the particular situation being considered. T minus and t plus can be different quantities, but in general t goes to t minus will be the initial singularity, and t goes to t plus will be the phase of infinite expansion. So in particular, t plus might be infinity. And what I'm interested in is looking at what happens in the asymptotic regime where the time coordinate t approaches one of these limits. And I want to introduce a terminology here which is not supposed to be something that I want to advocate should be used in general, but just for the convenience of this talk, I introduce this word tractable to describe a certain kind of class of problems where we can hope to make progress of a certain kind. And I call a problem tractable if the geometry and matter variables have a certain kind of asymptotic expansion, as a limit is approached, t goes to t plus or t goes to t minus. So I formulate this for a generic function f. You might think of it as a component of some tensor, or it might be the whole tensor, but I just formulate it here for a scalar function. So the idea is the following. I have certain functions g, I of t. These functions are what are sometimes called in the general theory of asymptotic expansions gauge functions. This has nothing to do with gauge symmetry in physics. This is something different. So these GIs are the gauge functions. And what I do is I form a finite sum, which is of the form a function of x. X here denotes the spatial coordinates collectively. So this sum is a function of x times a function of t plus a function of x times a function of t, and so on. And now what is written here is that if I take the function I'm interested in and I subtract off this quantity here, which is supposed to be an approximation, then this can be bounded by a constant times the next gauge function in the sequence. So these gauge functions are to be thought of as becoming smaller and smaller as n increases, or as I increases. And this norm here, I don't want to make a specific choice of this norm because depending on the particular applications, this might be various different norms. So this is just schematic at this point. I also want to make one further assumption for a tractable problem, namely that if I take this relation here and I differentiate everything term by term, either with respect to t or with respect to x, then the resulting relation is also true. So, of course, in general, you're not allowed to differentiate asymptotic expansions, but I'm assuming that these asymptotic expansions are such that they are preserved if you differentiate them term by term. And since this is a formula I want to come back to quite often, I'll put it over here. Okay, so this expression here looks quite general, so I think it's worth to make the comment that the existence of an expansion like this is a real restriction, so it's not satisfied just by any old function of t and x. And I've mentioned a couple of things here to try and make that clear. So supposing I have an expansion like this, and I look at the ratio of a spatial derivative of f to f itself, assuming that f is non-zero, then I'm able to get an asymptotic expansion for that quantity, namely that it's equal to the corresponding quotient for f naught plus something which goes to zero in the given limit. And now this function here is a function of x alone. All the coefficients fi only depend on x. That is to say, I can conclude from this relation that this function on spacetime converges to a function of x alone. And this is a non-trivial restriction. Another example here, if I simply take f to be a solution of the two-dimensional standard wave equation with periodic boundary conditions, then the periodicity in x implies periodicity in t, so that this function f, or any function f solving this equation for non-trivial initial data, will certainly not converge when t goes to infinity. It will just oscillate forever. So this is an example of a function which does not have an asymptotic expansion of this kind. And I introduce a little bit of terminology for this. So if I have this situation where this kind of expansion does not hold because of oscillations in time, I talk about persistent waves. And this is one kind of obstruction to getting this kind of expansion. I should say also, I mean, it's not enough to simply have decay. That's not enough by its own. By itself. So if, for instance, I consider the Gaudi solutions in the expanding direction, then I get a function which looks like, basically, like a solution of this equation multiplied by t to the minus a half. So the function decays. Nevertheless, I can't get an expansion of this type here. There are still these persistent waves. Okay, so this comment I've, in some sense, made already, that although these two asymptotic regimes we're considering seem to be very different, and in fact, physically, they are describing very different things, mathematically, there are some close similarities, analogies, and insights that we obtain in studying one of these problems can often be applied in studying the other one. In other words, insights coming from the one asymptotic regime can be applied to the other asymptotic regime. Okay, so now I want to give some examples of problems which are tractable in this particular sense. Firstly, I just would like to remark that if I consider generic solutions of the Einstein vacuum equations with zero cosmological constant, then this is not a tractable problem. Why is that? Well, we have to expect that if we go towards the past, towards the singularity, then there will be complicated oscillations, as suggested by Belinsky, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz, BKL. On the other hand, if we go towards the future, there will be, it is to be expected, there will be persistent oscillations in the sense that I introduced before. So in this case, neither the future direction nor the past direction can be expected to lead to a tractable problem. What is better is if we take a positive cosmological constant, and the next 5 minutes maybe has a certain overlap with what Mike Anderson talked about in his talk. So let us consider the future behavior of solutions of the vacuum Einstein equations with positive cosmological constant. And here there is a fundamental result due to Helmut Friedrich from 1986, which tells us, in fact, that this is a tractable problem in the sense I've introduced. In order to get this, we need to make a small data restriction. So for instance, if we start off with the de Sitter solution, which I've written here explicitly, with the constant H given by this expression in terms of the cosmological constant, and if I look at initial data close to the data for the de Sitter solution, then I find that it is possible to, on the basis of this theorem of Friedrich, it is possible to get an asymptotic expansion which is schematically of exactly the form that I've written up here. So that is one particular example. I should emphasize that here there is a kind of small data restriction or restricted data restriction, but there is no symmetry restriction. So this is really for solutions which are general in the sense that no symmetry is being assumed. And just a little bit more detail here. So what we can do is we can write the metric in Gauss coordinates, so it takes this form here. And once we've done that, the G0-naught component and the G0-i component, the mixed space-time component, have standard values, and so all we need to describe is the asymptotic expansion of the spatial metric, Gij. And here is the form, so this is, apart from the notation, basically something which Mike Anderson already showed us. So what you find is an expansion which is of this form, a function of x times a function of t plus a function of x times a function of t, which happens to be 1 here, plus a function of x times a function of t, etc. So this is exactly of the general form that I wrote down here. And the situation is that any data close enough to the Sitter initial data gives rise to a solution which has an asymptotic expansion of this kind. And the proof, in two words, uses conformal methods. By doing a conformal transformation and using the conformal field equations, it is enough. It is possible to transform this global problem into a local problem and then apply the local theory of hyperbolic equations. Now, because it uses the conformal field equations, this result is special to four dimensions. The proof is special to four dimensions. And as we heard a couple of days ago from Mike Anderson, he has found a new approach which allowed him to extend this result to any even-dimensional spacetime. So in that case, also for even-dimensional vacuum spacetimes with positive cosmological constant, we also get an expansion very similar to this. Similar to this. And as you heard in his talk, again, the proof uses conformal techniques of a somewhat different kind. Now, solutions of the Einstein equations with positive cosmological constant exhibit accelerated expansion, which is a topic of great interest in cosmology these days. And also in cosmology, other models are used to produce accelerated expansion. And in particular, an alternative to a scalar field, cosmological constant is a scalar field, a nonlinear scalar field with some suitable nonlinearity. So let us consider that case, the Einstein equations with now zero cosmological constant, but we replace the vacuum equations by the Einstein equations coupled to a nonlinear scalar field with a potential V of phi. One particular potential which has been considered quite often is the exponential potential. So V is a constant times an exponential function in phi with a constant, positive constant k. And in the spatially homogeneous case, it is known that if this constant k is small enough, then there will be accelerated expansion. So if the potential doesn't fall off too fast at infinity, then accelerated expansion is obtained. A difference from the case with cosmological constant is that, as you saw in the previous slide, in the case of a cosmological constant, we obtain exponential expansion, whereas in this case, with an exponential potential, we got power law expansion, except that the power is, well, the power is bigger than one, therefore it is still accelerated expansion. Okay, so now recently Mark Heinzler and I found a way to use the results of Anderson to prove something about this case here, a scalar field with an exponential potential. So what we did was we took Anderson's result in higher dimension and did Kaluza-Klein reduction on that. And what you find is that if you start off with the vacuum Einstein equations with cosmological constant in some higher dimension, well, even dimension in this case, then you obtain an effective system in four dimensions after you've got rid of the symmetry, which is exactly the model with an exponential scalar field, where the constant k here depends on the number of dimensions by which you have reduced. So in fact, what we have been able to prove here is that we can show that the problem of the Einstein equations coupled to an exponential scalar field is tractable if the potential is given by this formula and if the exponent k belongs to a certain discrete set. So all the possibilities we have to do this reduction are all the possible dimensions. So that's the integers that we have as an index set. And this gives us a discrete set of values of k. Now, we have absolutely no reason to believe that this result should depend on having only those discrete values of k. Actually, any sufficiently small value of k should give the same result, we would guess, but this particular proof only works for those discrete values.
What about the even, odd-dimensional, odd-higher dimensional values?
Yeah, so I'll have something to say about that very shortly. So here I've got a mistake. This should be a k equals minus 1 constant curvature metric. I've accidentally put a flat metric here instead. So I just wanted to make a remark that for the Einstein vacuum equations with zero cosmological constant, Lars Anderson and Vince Moncrief have got information on late-time asymptotics for small perturbations of the Milne model, which is what I've written down here, except that this should be the k equals minus 1 constant curvature metric. And what I wanted to say about this particular example is that although they were able to get good information about the asymptotics, this is not a tractable problem in the sense that I'm talking about here, because they have a certain description of the asymptotic behavior, but it's basically like having this here in the case capital N equals 1, or no, 0, I should say. So there is a one-term asymptotic expansion, but it's not possible to extend this asymptotic expansion to higher orders, at least. Well, I mean, it wasn't done, but it is to be presumed that it cannot be done, and the reason is persistent waves, and basically what is going on is that for a given rate of decay, you have solutions which oscillate at arbitrarily high frequencies. So one rate of decay and arbitrarily high frequencies combined suffice to prevent you getting this kind of expansion here. So it's quite a different situation from what you have for the case of a positive cosmological constant. Okay. So what I've been talking about up to now has all been about the expanding direction. And here, concerning the singularity, so going in the other direction, in fact, there is not a single case where the case of going towards the singularity for the vacuum Einstein equations has been proved to be tractable under the sole restriction of small initial data. So here I'm not talking about cases with symmetry, but if we concentrate on situations without symmetry, there isn't a single result here, unfortunately. Okay, so those are basically the results which we have, where we can really start from general initial data without symmetry and then determine the asymptotics. What alternatives are there? So suppose we have a situation where we cannot achieve that ideal goal, what else can we do? Well, one possibility is we can try to construct solutions with given asymptotics. In other words, we try to prove the existence of very general solutions with a particular kind of asymptotics, which are then of the type that I'm talking about here. So that's the next topic I want to discuss. Prescribed asymptotics. And there is a particular technique which has proved very useful in getting this kind of result. And this is the theory of Fuchsian systems. Fuchsian systems are a class of singular PDEs. And for these particular PDEs, there is a good existence theory. Now, maybe just a general remark about what is the essential property of Fuchsian PDEs. Well, if you look at what I today, or Satya Kichanasamy, who has worked on this, what we call Fuchsian systems, and if you look at what Lazarus Fuchs did in the middle of the 19th century, then you won't see a great similarity. So what is the similarity? Well, the similarity, which plays a great role in both cases, is that these equations have the property that if you can find a formal solution, in the sense of a formal series, then there is always a real solution that exists and has an asymptotic expansion given by the formal solution. So what this machinery allows you to do for a suitable class of equations is to take the step from formal expansions to genuine expansions of solutions which can be proved to exist. So maybe at this would be the point to answer Gary's question. So if we look now at the Einstein equations with positive cosmological constant and odd space-time dimension, then we have no theorem about the stability of the Sitter space as we do in even dimensions, but we can apply these Fuchsian techniques. So applying Fuchsian techniques, I was able to show in that case that there are large classes of solutions which have the same kind of asymptotic expansions as in even dimensions. The only major difference is that they contain logarithmic terms. So maybe I should bring back this slide. Briefly. So in odd dimensions, we can also get an expansion of this kind, but then when we come to the dimension, to the order n, where n is the space dimension, we get a term here of the form t times a power of e to the ht, which is logarithmic in the expansion parameter e to the ht. And it's presumably this kind of logarithmic term that prevents at least a straightforward application of conformal techniques. Because the conformal techniques, at least the way they've been used up to now, in the end show that some quantity is smooth. But if there is this logarithmic term, then the corresponding quantity will not be smooth. So that's a sort of obstruction. Anyway, I just wanted to say that Fuchsian techniques can also apply to that case.
I mean, my question was the following. Suppose you took four dimensions and you came down from six.
Yeah.
You apply your technique and you get a certain k value.
Yeah.
If you came down from five, you get a slightly different k value.
Yeah.
But in principle, you'd have a logarithm. So, but does the scalar field depend that sensitively on k, its behavior, or? Or is this just a technicality about your proof?
I think it's a technical aspect of the proof. That's my opinion. I mean, maybe there's some more clever way of doing things than what we did, but at the moment, we could only say it appears to be a technical restriction. Yeah?
It sounds as though would be reasonable to have as a goal a slightly more general theorem where if you, for any stress tensor which gave an accelerated Friedman solution that expanded forever, you should seek an expansion simply in powers of the scale factor of that solution, I mean, not needing to know if it's a scalar field or whatever, and then you might discover that there was some class of those solutions which where you had this impediment and some where you did not. But intuitively, any accelerating solution you expect to approach isotropy. And so it would be reasonable to expect that there's much more general theorem sitting out there somewhere.
Yeah, so it's certainly reasonable to try more general potentials, and this kind of thing is being done at the moment. So this is just the starting point in a sense.
I think you want to restrict to potentials, even, just that you can work at the level of a general stress tensor. It doesn't have to be a scalar field.
Well, it seems to me to be difficult to do anything without making an assumption of a particular matter model. I mean, whatever kind of matter model it may be, because when you do the expansions, you must also expand the matter fields. And somehow you'd like to know that if you give data at the highest level, if you like, I mean, at the sort of the first coefficient, then all the other coefficients should be determined. This is a prerequisite for getting this technique to work. And if you want to have things determined, you need to have equations of motion for the matter. And not just the divergence-free nature of the energy-momentum tensor. So I could imagine doing things for much more general matter models. Nevertheless, I can't imagine doing something without having a class for which the equations of motion are specified in some form.
Yeah, I was just imagining an energy condition on the components so that they couldn't fall off too slowly.
So this seems to me difficult, but maybe there are possibilities of that kind. Okay, so hooks in systems. I now want to go back to the initial singularity and again think about applications of Fuchsian systems. So if we approach the initial singularity then according to BKL, we must in general expect complicated oscillations as the singularity is approached. However, if we follow the BKL prescription, the heuristic prescription, then what we find is that if we have a scalar field, the oscillations go away. So for that reason, the structure of the singularity should be much simpler when a scalar field is present. And indeed, a couple of years ago, Lars Andersen and myself were able to show using Fuchsian techniques that there is a large class of solutions of the Einstein scalar field equations which near their initial singularities have expansions, I don't write down the explicit form, but have expansions which fit into this scheme here. And so this is also a tractable problem. So we've found some things that can help us to prove theorems in a sense, a cosmological constant or some other inflationary matter model in the expanding direction, a scalar field in the contracting direction. They can make our lives easier. Oh, I still haven't finished discussing that. So this expansion in the case of the Einstein scalar field equations near the singularity, they are such that the leading term is a homogeneous Bianchi type 1 solution, and this solution then varies from one spatial point to the next in such a way that the spatial coordinates are like parameters in the Bianchi 1 solution. And what this does is to confirm some of the main elements of the BKL picture in this case. So in particular, we see that near the singularity, the evolution at different spatial points decouples. This is what leads to an ordinary differential equation in the limit, so it can be modeled by a homogeneous solution, and the homogeneous solution depends on the spatial coordinates as parameters. A useful sort of diagnostic in this kind of situation is the following. So let us consider our time function as before. This defines a foliation of the spacetime by space-like hypersurfaces. We can look at its induced metric, or the induced metric of each slice and the second fundamental form, and look at the eigenvalues of the second fundamental form. And then we can define these expressions here, supposing that the mean curvature is non-zero, so that we can divide by it. We can define these quantities pi, the so-called generalized Kasner exponents. And they are useful in describing the qualitative nature of the asymptotic regime. In general, these generalized Kasner exponents depend on t and x, so they are functions on spacetime. And in this case I was talking about the Einstein scalar field near the singularity, these converge to some function pi infinity of x as t goes towards the singularity. And in fact, this is very similar to what Hans Ringström was talking about yesterday. His asymptotic velocity is closely related to this kind of quantity pi infinity here. So that's what happens in the case of the singularity. And in general, these are genuinely functions of x, so they're not just constants. There is real x dependence. On the other hand, if we look at the case of unending expansion with a cosmological constant, we see that in that case, the generalized Kasner exponents all tend to the constant value 1/3. And the constant value 1/3 corresponds to isotropy. So in that case, we can say that the geometry isotropizes. And from a mathematical point of view, this is a big advantage. So it's easier to handle this kind of situation with isotropization mathematically than it is to handle this kind of situation. I mean, we have certain theorems for both, but the isotropization should be a definite benefit. I wanted to mention one other generalization of this result on the application of Fuchsian methods to singularities. So if we go to space dimensions greater than or equal to 10 and look at the vacuum Einstein equations, then it has been known for some considerable time that in that case the BKL oscillations are supposed to go away. So if you make the same kind of analysis that BKL did many years ago, but in higher dimensions, then you find that above a certain dimension, the oscillations in generic solutions go away. And now this was confirmed in a rigorous sense in a paper by Thibaut Damour, Marc Henault, Marsha Weaver, and myself. And there we were really able to show that what can be proved for the Einstein scalar field system in four dimensions can be proved for the Einstein vacuum equations beyond 10 dimensions. Also, we were able to include a wide variety of matter models in this theorem, in particular those matter models which typically come up in low energy string theory, which is one of the situations where you might be interested in these higher dimensional cosmological models. Okay, so there are quite a few situations where we can apply these Fuchsian techniques. Nevertheless, there are limits to what we can do with that at the moment. And so it's worth to ask, well, suppose we have a problem where we don't know how to apply the Fuchsian techniques, what else can we do? And one thing is that instead of looking for genuine solutions whose existence we can demonstrate, which have actual asymptotic expansions, we can instead just look at formal asymptotic expansions and see whether, for a particular situation, we can obtain consistent formal asymptotic expansions which involve the maximum number of free functions and don't require any symmetry restrictions. So when we make this replacement, that is to say, genuine asymptotic expansions replaced by formal asymptotic expansions, then it's possible to get results for a positive cosmological constant and a perfect fluid with a linear equation of state. So, of course, one significant observational fact about our universe is that it's not empty. So most of the results I mentioned up to now were for empty spacetimes. It's good to be able to do something for spacetimes with matter as well, in particular the perfect fluid, which is commonly used by cosmologists. And formal asymptotic expansions for this kind of situation were first written down by Starobinsky quite a long time ago. And recently I was able to put this into a sort of clear mathematical framework and really prove results about formal asymptotic expansions. And I imagine that it's probably possible to use this information to apply, once again, Fuchsian techniques to this situation, but that hasn't been done yet. So at the moment, we're still on the level of formal expansions. Okay, this is something that I've essentially said already. So of all the results I've mentioned so far, this is the first one where we have been able to include ordinary phenomenological matter. So in the one result I mentioned, various field theoretic matter models were allowed, but actually for cosmology, we'd also like to be able to handle such things as perfect fluid or kinetic matter. So for describing galaxies, for instance. I just wanted to make one general remark about the relationship to what is done in cosmology in practice. Very often in cosmology, consideration is restricted to homogeneous models, And when people want to say something about inhomogeneous models, then they linearize about the homogeneous model. And I think it would be interesting to make the link between what is done in practice, in a sense, with linearized perturbations and those theorems we can prove in about the full nonlinear equation. So this is a question which deserves to be explored in more detail. There is one other result which I wanted to mention, which is on the level of formal asymptotic expansions. This is a recent result by Roger Bierli. What he did was he looked at the case of certain nonlinear scalar fields, which were also curvature coupled. And there he was able to get formal asymptotic expansions, which were, roughly speaking, of the form that I've written down here. Actually, when I say that, I'm cheating a little bit, because in this result, in contrast to the cases where Fuchsian methods have been applied up to now, there are oscillations which are involved. And strictly speaking, we don't get something of this form. However, we do get something which is very close to this form, in the sense that if we are prepared to take a certain formal series and lump a finite number of terms together at each stage, then we get something which is essentially this. So, I mean, really, it's a rather trivial difficulty, in the sense that you get something of the form, let's say, A e to the minus lambda cos omega t plus B e to the minus lambda sine omega t. So these are two terms which are decaying at the same rate, and so we should really lump them together if we want to produce a series like this, where each term decays faster than the previous one. In fact, there may be more than two terms, in the sense that you may have the same rate of decay for different frequencies, but the important thing is that for a given rate of decay, you only have a finite number of frequencies. So it's not like the situation of persistent waves I talked about before, where for one rate of decay, you can have arbitrarily high frequencies. So this is rather close to this setup, and rather close to the things that can be handled by Fuchsian techniques. And probably what it's going to mean is that when applying the Fuchsian techniques, you have a linearized operator, which in the example studied up to now had real eigenvalues, and which in this case is going to have eigenvalues which can be imaginary, but only finitely many for any given value of the real part. Anyway, this is work in progress to try and apply the Fuchsian techniques in this case. Okay. So the BKL picture is a very useful source of information about asymptotic expansions near the initial cosmological singularity, but these singularities are almost always accompanied by oscillations, and oscillations which are very complicated. So it seems rather difficult to write down any very useful asymptotic expansions for these. And up to now, there are no rigorous results for any class of inhomogeneous models which exhibits oscillations. So here, this is under the restriction that I'm talking now about results without any symmetry assumptions. So if I don't make any symmetry assumptions, the solutions are inhomogeneous and there are oscillations, then essentially nothing is known. I mean, there is one example due to Moncrief and Choquet-Bouin, I believe, of a finite dimensional family of solutions with these kinds of properties, but there's no general result at all. This seems to be something which we simply can't do mathematically up to now. Another kind of complication which can come up is what I call localized structure. So in that case, I consider some particular function which is describing the spacetime, and I look at this ratio gradient of f over f at some point where f is non-zero. This is the same quantity that I wrote up previously, and I said that if we have this kind of expansion here, then gradient of f over f will converge as you approach the limit. But what you find in certain cases is that, in fact, this quantity can diverge. So this is, in fact, the simplest case is the case of the spikes, which Hans Ringström was talking about yesterday. There, precisely, you will find that for certain quantities describing the solution, like the p's or q's that he had yesterday, this ratio will go to infinity at certain points as the singularity is approached. So this kind of behavior prevents the application of the tractable case, at least in any straightforward sense. So just to sum up on this, there is a variety of different heuristic and numerical approaches to the problem of the structure of initial singularities, but on the level of rigorous mathematics, we're waiting for the breakthrough. I mean, if we look at solutions with symmetry, model problems, which are very interesting, then I think it's justified to say that already what we heard from Hans yesterday deserves to be called a breakthrough. But if we are thinking about general solutions, we're very much in the dark at the moment. I wanted to mention one more example. So this is a class of rigorous results on the structure of singularities where no symmetry is assumed. And this concerns the subject of isotropic singularities, which are also sometimes called conformal singularities. This work was motivated by Penrose's viral curvature hypothesis. So Penrose's idea was that somehow gravitational entropy should be related to the Weyl tensor, and since for certain reasons you might like an initial singularity to have low entropy, then at the initial singularity the Weyl tensor, the Weyl curvature, should be bounded or maybe even go to zero. And so from this motivation it became interesting to try and find out how many solutions of the Einstein equations are there with a singularity where, in some appropriate sense, the Weyl curvature remains bounded or goes to zero. And this has been looked at either for matter described by the Euler equation, so perfect fluids with a linear equation of state, or for kinetic matter described by the Vlasov equation. So this was work by several people who I've listed here over this period, in particular the PhD thesis of Keith Angwich was on this subject. And so there are some very strong results on this question which show that in the situation of isotropic singularities, we do get a tractable problem in this sense. The techniques which were used to prove these results were not exactly Fuchsian techniques in the sense that I tend to use this terminology. Nevertheless, fundamentally, they were very similar. The class of equations which come up there look very much like Fuchsian equations. The details of the technical machinery were somewhat different, but the idea is basically the same. So here we actually find another useful application of Fuchsian methods. A last comment on this. So the result here is, if you compare what happens for Euler and what happens for Vlasov, for collisionless matter, then you find things look very different. So in this kind of situation, what you can essentially do is you can give initial data on the singularity, which determine a solution, a unique solution. And it turns out that for the Vlasov equation, you can give much more data than you can for the Euler equation. And it would be interesting to understand that in some more detail. Now, there is a situation which is in some sense intermediate between these two cases, and this is the Boltzmann equation. So the Boltzmann equation, if you set the collision time to zero, you get the Vlasov equation, and in a certain limit of high density, the Boltzmann equation goes over to the Euler equation. Therefore, in some sense, the Boltzmann equation seems to interpolate between the Euler and Vlasov cases. So the question then came up, what happens for Boltzmann? Does it look more like the Euler case, or does it look more like the Vlasov case? And in a recent paper with Paul Todd, he looked at this question. In fact, he didn't prove any existence theorems there, but he looked at the question on the level of formal expansions. And what he found was that the answer to this question depends very much what you assume about the collision kernel for the Boltzmann equation. So if the collision kernel is such that it increases very fast at high velocities or momenta, then things look like the Euler equation. If, on the other hand, the collision kernel increases less fast or is bounded, then things look like the Vlasov equation. So in a sense, you can see in this context the transition between the two regimes that had been seen previously. It would be interesting now, of course, to actually get an existence theorem for this. You haven't got one yet, I take it. So this is an interesting problem for somebody, I think.
Excuse me, are these results assuming smallness of the Weyl tensor or the Weyl curvature?
Okay, so this is an important point. How do you formulate this? So the way that things are actually formulated is that you say that the conformal structure should remain regular at the singularity. So it's actually, at the end of the day, you're not making a quantitative restriction on any aspect of the Weyl tensor, because there's always the problem, is it the tensor, is it the components in coordinates, is it components in a frame, etc. But a clean formulation is that you say the conformal structure should remain regular, although the metric itself is becoming singular. And that's the basis of this work, and it turns out to fit very well with the Einstein equations.
So it avoids you approaching a plane wave.
I don't know.
Invariance would be zero.
Anything about? So there's. I don't think there's anything related to a plane wave, as far as I know. I mean, in terms of these generalized Kasner exponents, you find that they all go to 1/3. So the geometry is becoming isotropic as you approach the singularity in that case. So that's a consequence of the assumption that the conformal structure remains regular. Okay, so let me come to my conclusions now. So there are various results on the asymptotics of cosmological solutions of the Einstein equations without any symmetries, and I've presented here those which I know, and I describe them here as tractable. In particular, Fuchsian techniques have been very successful, and I think they still have a lot of potential for other applications to the Einstein equations. And lastly, maybe the most important point, if the most negative, that the problem of getting rigorous results on oscillatory behavior in the asymptotics of inhomogeneous solutions is still wide open. No, stop there.
Hey, we have time for a few questions.
Okay. In the case of the homogeneous Bianchi models, there's some work to the effect that the asymptotic solution is dominated by a plane wave,
Yes.
Have there been any recent developments in that?
So those solutions which are plane wave dominated are the solutions of Bianchi class B, right? So in particular, those are the Bianchi models which cannot be compactified. Now, it's an interesting question, which I don't know the answer to, whether there's a connection between these two statements. So is it somehow is the fact of necessarily having a non-compact Cauchy surface linked to the occurrence of these kinds of asymptotic? So that's one question. But more specifically to your question, there have been recent results on the dynamics of models which are, of Bianchi class B models with perfect fluid. And in particular, there are some interesting results, I think, by Coley and Hervik, where they find some interesting behavior in the limit of infinite expansion, and they find attractors which are periodic or like torus attractors, and there seem to be a lot of interesting things going on there. This is at least, results supported by numerics. I mean, they're not rigorous results, but I think it's a question which should be understood better.
What about inhomogeneous models? Is there any indication how whether this result remains, or you can formulate it in the presence of inhomogeneity?
I don't know. So I think all the mathematical results, which is what I know most about, have concentrated on the case where you can have a compact Cauchy surface. Otherwise, things are, we don't know what to do. As far as other results are concerned, I don't know anything relevant.
There's an awkward theorem, isn't there? In the case where it's compact and you have killing vectors, then there are these results that Einstein equations are linearization unstable around solutions with symmetries.
Yes.
So taken at face value, that means, you know, if you took something like Bianchi type 9 mixed master behavior, if you imagine that there's a little mixed master-ish, slightly inhomogeneous solution close by, that implies there isn't. And you have to work harder and look at the second variations and so on. So where does the linearization and stability difficulty enter into your discussion? I mean, did it stop that type of expansion?
So I think there's somehow a problem with the use of the word instability here, because linearization instability doesn't have much to do with dynamical instability. So linearization instability has to do with the possibility of smoothly parametrizing families of solutions, and it's largely or maybe totally independent of questions about the long-time behavior or the behavior in the asymptotics going towards expansion or towards the singularity. So, I can't see a relevance of the question of, I should be careful. I can't see a fundamental relevance of the question of linearization stability to the questions of dynamical stability. There could be a technical relevance in the sense that one way you might like to prove something about small perturbations of a given solution would be you try to use the implicit function theorem or something, and if you try to do that, then linearization stability could get in your way because of some zero eigenvalues. But I think I would see that as being rather a technical than a fundamental problem.
Your results on we use fixing methods in the screening direction. That's all in the analytic case.
That's all in the analytic case. Yeah. Yeah. So that's this is something I didn't mention at all. That the main theorem, which is used in most of the Fuchsian results I mentioned, assumes analyticity of the initial data, and this is something, of course, one might like to get rid of. In the case of Gaudi solutions, I was able to get rid of that, so I was able to replace analytics by C infinity, and presumably you could do it for a Sobolev space if you wanted. Also, in the results on isotropic or conformal singularities, there the techniques being used were different and no analyticity was required. So I hope that the technical side will develop further so that we don't have to continue to rely on analyticity.
There are some results for simpler equations in Gevre classes
using
this type of expansion.
Why is the compactness of space so critical?
Well, if you're dealing with hyperbolic equations, you might like to use energy estimates. And it's certainly very convenient if you have a finite total energy. Right? I mean, there's at least two different ways of getting a finite total energy. You have enough fall off in a sort of non-compact situation, or the total volume is finite. So, I mean, of course, it's interesting to study an asymptotically flat kind of situation. That's one direction of studying the Einstein equations. In the context of cosmology, you maybe want to consider other boundary conditions, and the simplest ones are to take spatial compactness. So that's another way of getting only a finite amount of energy. So I would say, I mean, it's not the only thing, but this is, I mean, it's technical convenience. Really.
Yeah, I think we might bring it to a close. Thank you very much, Alan.